I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Today's guest is Julie Howard Hobson, who is the author of a new volume out from Countercurrents this year called I Do Not Belong to the Bader-Meinhof Group and Other Poems. You know Julie as a poet and also as an essayist and critic for Countercurrents. So Julie, welcome to the show.
Hello, Greg. Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk to you about who you are. Where were you born? Where did you go to school? Where do you live? And the different strands of your identity.
I was born in Portsmouth, England in 1963. My father was in the Navy. He married an American, so I went from there to New York City, Brooklyn, New York, as a matter of fact, Greenpoint, Brooklyn, to be exact. And I lived there until I was 11, whereas I soaked up a lot of family traditions because we had a great Lithuanian family that my mother's side. And I had great uncles, and I had houses that they lived in from the time they were born, and I had streets that had memories that weren't even my memories. They were great uncles who had died in the wars, memories that were passed down to me. We had all the Roman Catholic trappings. We had the altars with pictures of uncles and aunts who had passed on. I still have their dishes. I still have their pots. I have their photographs. I have their jewelry. I have all those things. And then my parents had some sort of conflict amongst themselves, and we moved to Australia, which was a bizarre move on one hand, but my father being English, it was better for him. He's still down there. And we had to simply stop being American and become Australian because you can't survive with a New York accent in Australia, especially in their public schools. And I went to high school there. And I loved everything about it. I didn't love it at first, but I loved it in the end. And everything about Australia back then in the 70s was still, from the British Empire point of view, it still had all the pomp and the ceremony, and they celebrated Anzac Day, and everything had a tradition to it. So I grew up in a lot of traditions, and it was right before the massive waves of immigration hit Australia, and we did not stay there that long. My father stayed down, but my mother dragged her family back to America, and where we ended up in California. And at first, California, being a non-traditional sort of place, was I didn't like it, but I found my feet. I really found, you know, a dissenting voice in the world through punk rock. And I just grew up there. But within the whole punk rock tradition of that, I held my own as far as I was writing formalist poetry at the age 16. So I was never, you know, an anarchistic monster. I was certainly a person who was a style and a defiance more than just a tantrum. And then I lived in California, and I got married, and I homeschooled and homebirthed, and then decided California was just too full of too much. It just became an odious place. It was too crowded. So we moved to Portland, Oregon, where we've been homeschooling successfully and have a micro farm, and I live and I write, and I do everything I like.
Well, that sounds like an idyllic life. How did you start writing poetry, and explain something to us. You describe yourself specifically as a formalist poet. What is formalist poetry as opposed to what?
Formalist poetry is a poetry that has form. It adheres to a form, a style, a tradition. It has meter. It usually rhymes. Some don't rhyme. Milton doesn't rhyme. Shakespeare sometimes doesn't rhyme. Shelley doesn't rhyme. But for the most part, you'll have rhyme. And it's expected rhyme or unexpected rhyme, but it's always there. And there's a cadence to it. It evokes old memories. Non-formalist poetry just can be anything. It's chaos. It's whatever it wants to be. Therefore, it has no standards, no quality. I mean, there are very good non-formalist poets. Zena Sunik is one of my favorites. She's wonderful. And I can give a nod to Charles Bukowski because even though I think some of his stuff is a little rank, he has a style. He's good. But for the rest of it, it's just unmitigated garbage. It can be whatever it wants to be, therefore it's nothing. Formalism, because it has a standard, it meets it or it doesn't meet the standard. It rhymes or it doesn't rhyme. It has cadence or it doesn't. I don't know why I liked it, but I did from the very first moment I'd ever read it. I suppose because, looking back, when I was a child, my father used to read poetry to us because he was English, and I think that he thought perhaps he was Michael Caine in the movie Alfie reading poetry to his child, but he would read poetry to us, and it just sunk in. And when I was 16, I was in school in Australia, and they were making us learn poetry. And I tried to always get a leg up on the Australians because they had the educational advantage over an American. So I went to the high school library and try to find out stuff about these poets before we were going to do them. And I found a book on John Keats, and I opened it up, and I really, really liked it. And I went home and just started writing poetry. As simplistic as that sounds, that's how it started. And I just kept writing it. And I like form, because with form, it's already there, and you can mold a thought to it. You build it. You take it, and word by word, you refine something that, in a sense, already exists in your head, the whatever it was you're going to write. It's already there in your ether, and you just build it and pull it out, and you put it in structure. And then you have a poem.
Yeah, I always thought that formalism in poetry or classicism in drama, however you want to understand it, some sense that there are set structures is not necessarily a thing that interferes with creativity. It's more like a trellis that, you know, lets the vine rise. It gives you something of a framework. And if you have just pure creativity, often you can't focus that. You've got to have something in mind, whether it's a goal or a form, to give it focus, and then you can start working in a particular direction and actually produce something.
That's exactly it. That's the difference between, say, a Jackson Pollock and a Whistler. A Whistler has a form. He evokes the same emotion to look at it as does a Pollock, I suppose, if you like Pollock. But Whistler, you know what it is, and he'll transcend time. You always know that that painting is of a woman in white. Whereas Pollock, if you didn't know that he was trying to capture jazz, you wouldn't know what it was. And it's 100,000 years from now, when they find them, they're going to think one is garbage, and they're going to think one is an excellent representation of a time.
They're going to think that one is Whistler and one is Whistler's drop cloth.
There you go. Absolutely.
Tell me about the poets who influenced you, and also tell us a bit about your favorite poets, both historically and in the contemporary poetical world.
My very favorite poet in the whole world, I suppose, would be Shelley. I love Shelley. I like everything about him, from his words to his life. He was a person who was committed to ideals and goals, and he faced a lot of social constraints, and he just didn't care, and he just kept doing his life. And his poetry is beautiful. It's clear-sighted. It works in the ether, again. It is not a base poetry. But I suppose of all the poets in the whole world, the one I think is technically the best would be John Keats. Although I don't know I'd get along with him if we sat down at dinner. I think his poems are the most solidly beautiful and well-made in the English language. The other poets I like would be Leigh Hunt, because he went to jail for his convictions, and I often thought that he was a wonderful person. As far as contemporary poets, it's hard. You know, there are some out there I really like. But because we're on opposite sides of the fence, I don't even bother with them anymore. And I like Zena Sunik. I love everything Leo Yankovic writes, and I like Joseph Salami. I think he's a very vivid poet. I don't always agree with everything he writes, but I like him a lot too. Other influences on me would be A.A. Houseman. I think the biggest influence Houseman had on me was he was the first poet I'd read after I read a huge bout of the Romantics, and they write very long epics. And Houseman writes shorter poems, often just one page. And that really, I thought, was wonderful, because I tend to write shorter poems. And I felt maybe I should write longer poems, because I was young at the time and didn't realize you have to find your own voice and your own style. And I saw that he didn't, and I thought, yes, I don't have to. There's someone else who's, you know, wonderful and doesn't do that, so I don't have to do it either. So Houseman's up there, my little stars.
What do you think of Ezra Pound, and what do you think of Philip Larkin?
I like both of them as people. I don't like either of their poems, their poetries. I don't like Larkin much. He's a different kind of writer than I am, as is Pound. They don't work in the same milieu. I don't think we have the same artistic vision, yet I think I could sit down at dinner with them and probably have a lot of common ground, which is good. We would never compete with each other.
That's great. That's a very good, honest answer. I think that my favorite two poets in English are William Blake and Yeats. What's your take on them?
They are very spiritual poets. Blake relates to Shelley. Blake, Mary Shelley married Percy Shelley. Well, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley married Percy Shelley, but Mary Wollstonecraft's mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, knew Blake, I believe. And so through there, I read Blake's works, and I find him a very spiritually interesting poet. And Yeats, I don't care for Yeats too much. He hits too much of the modernist. I like his myths and fairy tales more than I like Yeats's poems. I don't know how well, although he's an Irish nationalist, and I always support Irish nationalists. I think that they're clear-headed.
There's a section in your book that we published, the I Do Not Belong to the Bader Meinhof Group volume, called Eye Deep in Hell. I thought that that was a quote from a poem by Ezra Pound, the Hugh Selwyn Moberly poem. But was it instead something else? Is there a common source for both of you, or is that a Pound allusion?
Eye Deep in Hell is a title of a book about World War One, as well as probably a line from Pound. Because there's no copyright in titles, I used it. I just found it such an evocative image. I had that book for ages. It's about being in the trenches, about being in the mud, so it just covers everything I've always thought about what it would have been like to have been in World War One.
You've written a lot of war poems and a lot of World War One specifically related poems. What captures your imagination about that time? Next year is the 100th anniversary of its beginning, and it really, to me, it's something that I don't know as much about as I would like. I'm going to spend a lot of time next year reading about it. That's one of my resolutions for the new year. What's poetically potent about that war, and what are you trying to say about it?
I know a lot about World War One for two reasons. Number one, my great-granddad was in the war. The Howards lost all their horses. The British government took our horses, paid them £50 apiece, and that's, the family story says that's how we lost our fortune. And they took all the horses, and my great-granddad went over with them as an Army Service Corps man to train the horses to not be scared of the noise. And he was gassed over there, and the stories of just how awful it was have been passed down that way. And I have all his buttons and all his bits from his uniform. And so it's always been there. And in Australia, they celebrate Anzac Day, and it's a huge, what, I don't know if they celebrate it anymore, but it was a huge day of just stopping and thinking about all those Australian, New Zealand Army Corps men who died in Gallipoli. And they've got huge war memorials up, and as a child I used to go see them, and it just seeped into my consciousness. And then as I got older and I realized that that was the most horrific thing that ever happened to Western civilization, it became more and more important to me to ferret out why we did that, why we would go over there, why we would let ourselves just go over trenches knowing that we would be machine gunned down. And for the longest time, I only looked at it from the British point of view, the British Australian, and then I opened up wider and I started looking at it from the German point of view as well, and I realized that it was the first of, you know, just a horrific brother war with our folk, and it was the beginning of the end. And it's just such a horrible, cancerous, ulcerous rupture of everything we had, and it was the beginning of the unraveling. So it just, every time I think of where we're at now, I go right back to World War One. And on a completely other tack, if you want to think I'm a complete insane person, I firmly believe in reincarnation. I think I must have been there, obviously as a nurse, but I think I was there, because I can so vividly, absolutely see the trenches and almost, you know, hear it. It's horrible. But that's where I come from with World War One. It's a huge magnetic draw for me.
So tell us how you create poems. Do you have a set time of day when you sit down and crank out a certain number of words? Do you, you know, wait for inspiration while you're puttering around in the garden? What's the working life of a poet like?
It's absolute chaos. I don't, as the only area of my life in which chaos reigns, and I suppose it has to. Nigel Pennick talks about in a formal farm in England, you'd have the farms, the farm, you'd always have a corner that was left wild for the whites to live in and the spirits of the land. And that's where poetry is in my life. I just write whenever. I have no set time. I have no set goals. I just write. I sometimes write in libraries, or I'll sit at the table and write. I don't even have a set desk or an office. My computer is in the kitchen. I'm fully integrated in every aspect of life. I don't even intend to write the poems that I write. I feel that somehow they exist inside me, and I pull them out. And as I'm pulling them out, I'm forming them. Usually they come out as sonnets. I just bam, 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 four quatrains, and now I'm in there. And then I write the final couplet, and it's done. And I often just refine them. They come out pretty much as they are. And if I do a form, for example, a sestina, and I'm playing with words because a sestina is technically difficult. I already know where it's going. I just sort of form it in there. I don't know where they come from. I can't tell you. I know people always want to know where people draw from. I draw from some big, deep reservoir of pain, angst, happiness, gloriousness, wonder, sadness, sorrow. I draw from all of that, and depending on what mood I'm in and who I've been reading lately and what I've been eating lately or what the sky is looking like to me, that's what comes out that day. It's never planned. I'm very hard on myself. If I find that I haven't been writing for a while, I'll innerly berate myself and make sure that I do sit down and take time to write something. I've written short stories, I've written nonfiction, and those things I can write more to a schedule. So I know deadlines and schedules. I can force myself to write any kind of prose, you know, at any time to a certain level. But the poems, I can berate myself to write more, but I can't tell myself when I'm going to sit down and do them. They just are there.
But you also write occasional pieces. You've written pieces on Francis Parker Yaki and on Savitri Devi. You've written things for Unity Mitford on her birthday, mm-hmm. Enoch Powell for his centenary, something in memoriam of Jonathan Bowden. So it's not just inner chaos, right?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I understand there'll be a theme out there that, and sometimes you've even asked me, Unity Mitford's birthday's coming up, and I will say, oh, it is. And I sit down and I think about her. And I guess what happens is that if it's a big revolving chaos, that facet that is Unity Mitford in my brain comes to the forefront. And the poem that I ultimately would have written about her, who knows when, comes that day. I can write it on time. I can deliver it then. It's like I have to want that one. I don't know where they come from. And they're just there. And the Jonathan Bowden poem I wrote, because I was so terribly sad that he had passed, and it just came out. And that's why they often come out as sonnets again, because for a sonnet, something in my brain thinks in sonnets. If it's not a sonnet, it's usually something I've worked on a little harder. The sonnets just spill. And you could say in that sense, I don't write them. The other writes them. Picasso used to talk about the other. Yes, but I don't know who the other is. The other is me, but it's me, but it's not me. And I can't even repeat them after I've written them. It's very strange. As soon as I go back and reread something I've written 5 years ago, I'm like, wow, that's just really nice. I'm really glad I wrote that. But I don't, it's a very odd thing, my writing poetry.
So there is this other there, but the other does take requests.
The other seems to like requests. Yeah, she'll write. She'll go in and fetch whatever it is I need, I suppose, for inspiration. Yeah, and deliver. Yeah, the other is very good at that.
Well, I think that having an aim like a poem for a particular day or on a particular person, that is one of those things that can sort of crystallize your creativity, like
absolutely
the sonnet form or something like that. So tell us about Azatru. That is one of the things that's very prominent in your poetry. What does it mean, and what does it mean to you?
I pronounce it Azatru, but my pronunciations are completely wrong. I have a New York, Australian, Californian Cockney accent, right, going in my head at all times. As far as Azatru is for me, I'm almost hesitant to call myself Azatru anymore. I almost call myself straight heathen, because I've almost widened my worldview to encompass, for example, like the Lithuanian Romuva and some Slavic things, which I see all as the same. There's an indigenous European spirituality that's in our blood. It's who we are. It's the way we look at the sunshine. It's the way we think of trees. It's the way we name our children. It's what the food that we connect with. It's everything about us. And it's in a way that once you've, I can't really describe it. It's like describing water if you're a fish. It is just where I am. I was pagan, you know, as a small child. I just knew that there were more than one God. And I knew that there was reincarnation. And I knew that certain things were ways they certainly weren't. They certainly weren't the way the Catholic Church was saying it. And when I found Azatru, I read it and I was like, this is it. This is it. This is exactly it. This is so right. And everything fell into place. Now, you could say I was predisposed to be Azatru because my grandfather on my mother's side was Danish. I'm Danish-Lithuanian on that side. And his Danishness, they might have been, you know, technically Lutheran, but they were drink cherry, you know, whatever, cherry herring, and they hold it up and they say, to Odin, you know, and they drink it down. And it's always been there. And they would argue with that horrible movie, The Vikings. You know, they'd be like, that's not how it was. And so I grew up with a consciousness that there was another layer of who we were there. I guess my entire life is based on the fact that there's tons of traditions and layers behind me that I didn't even know were in place. And being Asatru just, it answers so many questions as to like why I am who I am and why I look upon the folk as a folk and why I think it's so imperative that we reconnect with who we are and why, I suppose, why I microfarm, why I homeschool, why I home birthed, all those things. Is that a good enough answer or should I be more technical as to?
No, that's a great answer. That's a great answer. So tell us a little bit about ritual. Does ritual play a part in your life? And also, does a religious community play a part in your life? Or are you more off on your own?
We are part of a community. We go in and out of communities. It's very hard. At first, up here in the Pacific Northwest, we were very involved with the Asatru Folk Assembly. And we had a lot of community. And it was truly wonderful. And as organizations go, the members tend to come and go. We're still with the AFA, and we're also with the Edenic Rite. So we have two separate communities going at all times, and I'm able to bridge that gap, although the two organizations don't really gel that well. We also have a lot of friends that are neither, you know, AFA or OR members. They're simply heathens, or you have a few witches and, you know, the odd pagan out there. We have a community of people. We come together, especially during the high holy times. If we have nobody, we'll just do ritual. We'll just do something ourselves. But we tend to group with others and share ritual. Yule is, for us, the biggest ritual. And we don't celebrate it in a commercial, Christmassy type way. We celebrate Yule in a very holy way. We have 12 days. We do not exchange presents. We do not enter into the commercial crassness. We have a small tree. We decorate it with old decorations. Everything's U.S. or European made. We don't do any Chinese or don't even do Japanese. We use it as a time for stillness and a time for centering. Ostara, which is Easter time, again, we don't really do the crass commercialization of chocolate bunnies and jelly beans. We try to keep it very ritualistic, very holy. You might say, oh no, your children are being deprived, but my children are not deprived of anything. They're homeschooled. They get anything they want, essentially, out of life. They know that they don't need to interrupt holy times with you know, requests for Nintendo or something. They're completely fine with it. It does keep them distinct from the mass of people out there, but that's a good thing, and they know that. And there's nothing wrong with being distinct, and there's nothing wrong with being spiritual, and there's nothing wrong with being who you are. So, and they've grown up with tons of children like themselves, so. They, you know, again, they're fine. It's not even a case of them having to adapt. It's a case of they are who they are, and we are who we are. And we have ritual. We have an altar in our living room. We have a section of our farm that's wild. Sometimes it's a little too wild, but we leave it go. We always give the first of our harvest to the land whites. We always offer things to the land whites. We hold bloat, which is a ritual of mead and passing the horn. We do all of these things, and we do them all with serious intent, but we don't parody anything. If we're not feeling it, if we're not feeling the connection to the divine, we don't do it. But so far, we always feel the connection to the divine. It's always there. It's like a live wire. We don't put it away and take it out. We don't have Sunday services. We don't have special, you know, moments. We just always are who we are, and some days we just bring it to the next level, and we take out this or that ritual bowl or that ritual plate. We have certain, you know, we have a ritual horn, and we have things like that. But for the most part, our religion is a lot like, if you want to compare it to anything, it'd be like the Amish. We are who we are, and every day we are who we are, and every day we pass our altar, and every day we have the books on our shelves that are our holy books, and every day we go to our farm, and we pass our wild place, and we pass the offering we've left. So it's a daily thing, and we don't hide it. Our neighbors all know that, you know, I don't know. I mean, we don't certainly sit down and say, I worship Odin, you know, wander around doing that. But they certainly know that we're not the same as them. And we make no bones about being heathen if we're asked. And, you know, very proud of it. And we just are who we are. And we're very happy doing it. And I guess that does, that informs my writing, because when you are solidly who you are, it has to inform every part of your body and every part of what you do. We're not afraid. We don't hide in the shadows. Because we don't think there's anything wrong with us. That's another aspect. Many people think, oh, I'd love to do that, but I know I'm afraid that people... It's like, what is there to be afraid of? What are you afraid of in yourself? It's yourself that's causing your panic or your fear. I know I'm right. I know I'm right in every single one of my points of view. I know I'm right in my spirituality. I know I'm right in the way I engage with life. I'm correct.
So how do you deal with modernity? You have these views. You have this identity. You're very secure in it. And yet you get in a car and you drive to shopping malls and you deal with commercialism and shallowness and materialism. How do you deal with alienation?
Yeah.
How do your kids deal with it?
My kids, well, we'll answer the kids first. They don't really care much about a lot of the things that would concern you and I, because we've grown up one way and changed to another in a sense. My kids have always just been full contact heathens, so they've never had to engage in the world any other way. There's certain things that they like that I don't like that they still do. Like they have video games. They go to manga conventions. You know, they want to learn Japanese. That's fine. It's all one big world, but they certainly share a lot of our points of views, and they share our common heritage, and they share our culture, and they share our beliefs, and the other stuff. You know, a lot like, again, bring it to the Amish. And so, you know, it's going to be a little bit of rump springing, I suppose, but not too much, certainly. And I have no problem with, you know, them ordering, you know, some stupid glitzy jewelry or wearing a t-shirt that's within, you know, the boundaries of taste that I don't particularly like. Like, for example, they watch Supernatural or Once Upon a Time. And there's a lot of things I could pick about them and be critical about. But on the whole, okay. That's fine. You know, everyone's got to, you got to come to your own conclusions too in this world. If people just feed you things, you'll never learn. So they have those things. And as far as myself and Dave, we exist in the world. We go to Winco. We have to go to shopping malls every so often. No, we minimize it. We minimize it as much as possible. That's the first key. You know, we have no debt. We don't have to go out and deal with these things. We've minimized so much. We try to, you know, cook from scratch. We try to rebuild things out of secondhand things. We find it really neat to be as self-sufficient as possible. But you can't be self-sufficient in everything. I don't mill my own flour. I don't grow my own sugar beets. So, you know, we've got to go get those things. And some days it's really irritating. I mean, I just, yuck. I hate it. I come home and I'm spitting venom. And other days it just is what it is. And I just hope for a better time and a better place, and know that, you know, sometimes the fleas cover the dog, and sometimes the dog shakes the fleas off, and sometimes you have to find a new dog, I suppose. But you just do the best you can, and know that the world is this way right now. It wasn't always this way, and it won't always be this way. I won't always have to deal with things I don't want to deal with. So we just deal with it that way. And there's parts of modern life that are very, very good. I love eBay. Or I used to love it. It's getting bad now, but you can find such wonderful old books on there. I like the convenience of Amazon.com. I like the convenience of Skype. There's many things you could say that, you know, the modern world, these are great advantages. These are good things. And then there's other things in the modern world, like, you know, Throwaway or Panda Express or, you know, garbage like that. I wish it wasn't here. It's just a balance. And it's all also patience and wisdom and polishing of the facets that we are also very important things to learn. You can't, if you never have anything to push against, you'll never grow.
Yeah, it's back to that classical formal thing. Sometimes the things that are just thrown down in your path are an occasion for you to step up or step over. To
exactly
go back to Jonathan Bowden a bit. So you're a homeschooler. Tell us a little bit about that.
We've been homeschooling our entire parenting lives. We never even thought about putting them in schools. We were so disgusted with the state of society and the state of schooling that it never even crossed our minds. We had my first child in a hospital, although we we didn't really intend to. We thought we had a midwife who was simply offering us a birthing experience within a hospital. And turns out that she was rather hypocritical, and we ended up having a full-blown American birth experience. And it was disgusting, and we hated it. And we had a fight to keep our baby in our room, let alone, you know, do anything. And they acted like we were completely nuts to not have my daughter taken away from me the minute she was born. And we wouldn't stand for it. So they weren't able to whisk our daughter away, and they weren't able to do all the things they wanted to do, who knows what. So from that moment on, we said, we're not ever doing this again. And we didn't even know that home birth existed. And we bumped into a hippie in Davis. And he said, oh, well, you know, I'm having a home birth. And we're like, really? And, you know, wow, we went down that rabbit hole and found a wonderful midwife and had our second and third child at home. And once you get into that home birthing world, you meet a lot of fluffy hippie types, but you also meet a lot of very committed individuals with a lot of very strong points of view. And the very few of them ever put their children in any kind of establishment, system, institution. And we're like, this is wonderful. And we met teenagers who had been homeschooled, and they were completely free, and they were deep thinkers, and they were kind, and they were nice, and they were very intelligent. And we just said, well, this is what we're going to do. And California, of course, is hard to homeschool, and their laws are vague, so they can attack you with them any time. So we looked all around America to find the best homeschool law state, and it's Texas, Idaho, Alaska, and Oregon. And we just ended up in Oregon. And we like Portland. Portland has a wonderful homeschooling community, so we're, you know, been very happy homeschooling here. There's too many things to do, if anything. And as far as where you're going to go with the homeschooling, we're completely against any kind of formal education at this point, at least system education. Formal education the way they used to do it, perhaps, but the way it stands nowadays, no. You know, I've got a degree, but I've never used it. I mean, maybe I use it, maybe that's why I write, but I was writing before I started the English degree, and I actually used to have to consciously shut myself off to not argue back, so I would actually get a passing grade in some of these classes. So we don't think our children are even probably going to go to universities at this point, because we don't want them to be saddled with the debt of the college loans. We want them to grow up and become artists and actors and perhaps a game designer. We've got one of those in the wings. But doing it on their own with you know, just committed from very young with no debt, with no need to go out and just grab any crappy job that's out there and just use their intuition and go ahead and do it. And, of course, they'll always have mom and dad to fall back on, because we don't plan on abandoning them to the wolves. So that's why we homeschool. And homeschooling, it's you know, it's both tough and easy. It's easy because it's very natural. If anyone can do it, there's this myth that you have to be a teacher and you must be very expert in this one subject, and every one of these teachers must be an expert. But have you really stopped to look at teachers? They're a lot like nurses. They're not experts. There's so many people standing in front of a bunch of kids they're trying to keep a control over and trying to impart something, anything. And it's not really a good situation. Even when I was a small child and I was going to Catholic schools in New York, that I didn't learn anything any more than my children learn here at the kitchen table, or they learn through interacting. And then, you know, they do take classes. They take violin classes or piano classes or acting classes or graphic design classes as they want to. And as far as all the small things in life, like, oh, learning geography or figuring out, you know, algebra, you can do it. You can do any one of those things within a week. You can learn how to do the basics of it. We were learning Hungarian, which is an extremely difficult language. It's nothing like English at all. And we're getting pretty good at it. And we've only been doing it for a couple of months. So you can do anything, because the blinders of not being able to do it are taken away. And just the realization that I can do this. You can pick up a fiddle and you can start playing it because you know how to play piano. You can do it. You can write poems. You can paint. It's just there. You can learn the history of anything in a week. You can learn anything you need to learn in a book. It's all out there. So I love homeschooling. The only tough part about homeschooling is the, you know, because we're hardening ourselves. It's a parental doubt. Like, oh no, did I do the wrong thing? Oh, did I, you know, maybe I should have just been completely a Stepford wife type suburban mom and just made their lives easier and just told them that this multicultural, diverse and wonderful world of ours is just it. This is the best. And just not have them question anything so they won't grow up with any kind of conflict. And then I think, nah, no, that's not right. So we'll just keep doing the way we're doing it. And we've got great kids, and great friends, and they're on their way, and they win art shows, and they get published, and they get in plays, and I get published, and my husband does his things, and we have a farm, and it's all wonderful. We have a really, really wonderful life.
It sounds like a wonderful life, and I think it's very wise to avoid the debt incurred by college. You know, I have student loans, but they're nothing like the student loans of people coming out these days. By the same token, education today is such a thin PC gruel.
Yeah.
And you really, really have to self-educate even when you go to college. Most of what I learned in college, I learned through my own efforts. I did learn certain technical things in certain classes where it was just best to have somebody up there explaining microeconomics and things like that. But actually, I found that the technically most difficult things I learned in college, I couldn't learn in classes because they would just give you tiny little portions. Mm-hmm. And discuss it endlessly, and it would be so boring. I remember when I took symbolic logic, I just dropped out after the first week because it was too boring. And when I finally had to fulfill my symbolic logic requirement, I cracked open a book, worked through it in 1 week, and finished it. And I knew all I needed to know. So the combination of the low quality of contemporary education and the ruinous costs, I just think it isn't an advantage to have a college degree anymore. It's a massive disadvantage because it wastes time and it incurs crushing debt, and you go out into the world with a massive amount of debt and a head full of mush and a lot of time that could have been spent learning things and growing as a human being has been wasted. It just sounds like a terrible proposition to me now.
I think so, too. And I also think not only is it a waste of your time as a young person, it wastes your future life. We were just at the bank, and the teller asked, you know, what we do, and Dave just said, oh, I'm an artist. And she said, oh, I was an art major in college. And it was so sad because now here you are, you're working in a bank, and, you know, I'm assuming she has a college debt she's got to pay off, and what are you going to do? You're never going to go out and do art. You know, you probably don't have enough time to – it just seems like such a waste. It's like if you want to be an artist – don't go to college. Be an artist. It's going to be tough, and you might have to live in a crappy apartment somewhere, and you might have to eat top ramen, which, you know, very, very ugly food. But you can still do it, because by the time you're 35, if you've committed and you're really doing it, you'll be on your way. But if you stay in that bank and you're paying off that college loan, when you're 35, you probably won't even have enough decent credit to buy a house. And then if you do buy a house, you know, you're going to have to work because you're going to have all this other debt, and your kids will go to daycare if you have kids. It's just, I think college is such a scam pulled on the best and brightest. I really do. I think it's right up there with World War I in a lot of senses. And I know that sounds sacrilegious, but you take a generation and you devastate them. If you don't devastate them through war or taking away men they would have married, you devastate them by putting them in these institutions that completely cloud up their brains and shackle them. I mean, they might as well be slaves. If you cannot decide in the morning, I'm not going to work. Matter of fact, I'm going to quit and just go live in a mountain and eat berries. If you can't decide that because the government's going to come after you to repay that debt you owe them, then you're a slave. It's absolutely, it boggles my mind that people aren't seeing this. I mean, we, you know, we have a lot of friends who've got homeschool teenagers, and they're looking at college, and it's hard. You know, you feel like telling them, like, hey, but sometimes people have to, you know, they have to tread that path for this life, right? And then come back and say, oh, I'm not doing that again. But it's hard to watch.
I think that apprenticeship is a really great system of passing on knowledge and skills. Mm-hmm. And it would be interesting to see if apprenticeship will return in this world once people, I think, liberate themselves from higher education racket and focus on what they want to learn. Are they going to be going off and living with a master carpenter or something and learning the trade, or a master bookbinder and learning the trade? I think that's a direction that I would like to see more of.
I think it's going to come about. I mean, we're watching people now get interested in, you know, there's a slow food movement. There's, you know, I'm a girl, so the knitting and embroidery, and that's a very, very big segment of creative people's lives, at least. I don't know about the average person, but a lot of people I know knit and crochet now, and they're learning how. And there's women, older women, who learned how to do this in the 70s, and now they're, in a sense, they're apprenticing to these younger women and showing them how to do this, showing them how to sew, showing them how to make their own patterns, showing them how to customize sweaters. And more and more people are like, that's what I want to do. And I don't want to work in a bank. I don't want to do this. I want to create, I want to, or make wooden bowls, or, you know, like you said, in construction. Dave was an apprentice. He was an apprentice at Auto Body Tech. And that's how he learned all his metal work. And people want this. People used to envy him. And they'd be like, well, Dave, I can't believe you're getting to do this. And you didn't have to go to college. And it's like, well, I was an apprentice. It was very, very hard work. So I think the consciousness is coming back. Again, it's going to come back to the 2% first, then the 15%, and then hopefully the majority of, our culture. We'll go back to that.
So, Julie, you are also a publisher. Tell us a bit about your publishing enterprises.
I'm more of the bottle washer over in publishing, but Raven's Hollow Arts is a small imprint that does small artsy books. We brought out a couple of my books and a couple of Rune Guild. D. Jonathan Jones is a Rune Guild. He's a master, and he wrote some rune poems that are the most beautiful rune poems I've ever read in my life. And I put out a chapbook, and I needed a little publisher to publish it, so I did it myself. And I submitted the chapbook to lots of places to get reviews. And one of the places I submitted to was Runa Magazine over in England. And Runa, they reviewed it. They reviewed it very nicely. And from that, D. Jonathan Jones, because he's a Rune Guild member, he contacted Raven's Hollow and asked if we'd be interested in putting out his poem. And it was, without a doubt, something that was unexpectedly brilliant and unexpectedly beautiful. And yes, and because I'm not a very detail-oriented person in layout and caring about page numbers and stuff, Dave does all that stuff. I do the artistic side. And we've got some small distribution, but it's more of a labor of love than a big publishing house, although everything should grow, I suppose, organically. We're coming out with a book of, its working title is Runic Yoga, but it's probably, its real title is going to be The Physical Magic of the Runes, and it's about how to take the Norse runes and physically embody them and magically hold it in that position and empower yourself through them. And the author is a runic yogi, and I'm writing some rune sonnets to go with each of them, and we've got a really lovely illustrator. He's a tattoo artist who's going to be illustrating each one of these stances. So that's our latest project.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And I think that the whole heading of this interview could really be labors of love, because I think that's really a way of refocusing the mind in the modern world towards a more authentic form of existence. Are you doing it for love or for money? That's the great choice, right, in Wagner's Ring.
Absolutely.
It sounds like you really are cleaving to the path of doing things that you love for the right reasons. So, Julie, thank you so much for sharing, and we look forward to more of your work.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so happy that you asked me to do this podcast, and you know that I love being attached with Countercurrents.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.